5, drummer Leopoldo Mbira Shekere, Kevin N, lyricist Rosé. I was talking about doing a ceremony. We'll have a Tibetan bowl, some chanting, some prayers.
Yes,
and we're going to be honoring Pachamama, Mother Earth. And this is just a way of saying that we are becoming once again a human humanity.
Yes.
So sacred partnerships all around. And it's wonderful, certainly, to be someone, as you even heard from the callers, who an older generation, but is very welcoming to the radiance and brilliance of our young people. So
yes,
thank you.
Appreciate it.
For bringing your brilliance here today.
And thank you for having me.
Yes, Paulette?
And indeed, it was a wonderful surprise, and hopefully we hear and get to see you and speak with you again on these
definitely
airways.
Definitely.
So I'm going to go out playing again Women of the World.
Yes.
Okay. As we come back to our next show, Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund.
Brooklyn. Oh. Check. Keep it. Happy to be here. Let me talk to you real quick. Tell what's been on my mind. To the mothers that care for us. In times of pain, shed tears for us. In times of fame, they cheered for us. Deserve to reign just for bearing us. Inside the stomach where we lie and love it. Always kept it real, never lied or fronted. With goals to accomplish, you tried and done it. With cheers to astonish and open the eyes of hunters. All the women in the world, this one's for you. Straight from the heart, this was done for you. When I'm scared, I would run to you. But can we switch roles? Mama, can I comfort you? Put my hands in the sky, grab the sun for you. Be a man and a son for you. My love is true, screw daddy, I will run from you. I'll bust my gun for you, squeezing the steel. Mama, I know what's wrong, I'm just keeping it real. Let me break my back to make a meal. Let me work two jobs to pay the bills. Let me take your pain, take your strain. Any sins in the past, let me take the blame. And that's word to my name and honor. I love you, mama, I love you, mama. Women in the world, this one's for you. To the mothers and the sisters that kept it true. To the wives and the lives we obey at once. Cause of the love and the pain within 9 months. To the women in the world, this one's for you. To the mothers and the sisters that kept it true. To the wives and the lives we obey at once. Cause of the love and the pain within 9 months. To the women of the world.
My father too. Good morning. This is Howard Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jeff. With us on the I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. There's a certain sense of fury that runs through the films of British director Ben Wheatley that's uniquely his own. Even when it isn't overt, its presence is unmistakable. It's like being aware of a poisonous snake in the room, knowing it could strike at any moment. So whether it's a Shakespearean gangster film like Down Terrace or a tale of hitmen that turns into a surreal horror story like Kill List, or the story of vacationers that veers into the blackest of comedies like Sightseers, when you enter a Wheatley film, you're already at a certain pitched level of tension, and the film is as much about when the release will come as it is about anything else. That ongoing state of incipient violence works well for those films, and I do recommend, at the very least, your tracking down and checking out Kill List. In Wheatley's new film, High Rise, which opens May 13th, it doesn't quite pay off as strongly. It could well be that the story being told and the emotional arc it has to follow isn't as compatible with the director's customary approach. The film is based on the mid-70s novel by J.G. Ballard about an ultra-modern, self-contained apartment building, all the amenities you could ever want or need, whose inhabitants devolve into tribal violence as support systems fail, and the people living there find themselves, much like the partygoers of Buñuel's The Exterminating Angel, incapable of taking the basic step of simply leaving. High Rise, like Exterminating Angel, is meant to be social satire, with the class system being replicated in the distribution of the building's tenancy, plebes on the lower levels, all the way up to a penthouse where the elite can gallop horses amidst a lush garden, and partygoers dress up as pre-revolution French aristocracy. That detail may well be from Ballard's novel. I haven't read it, so I can't say. But it's also a little too bluntly obvious, and that bluntness, and maybe the British notion of a clearly striated class system, undoes how the film flows. Wheatley doesn't really finesse the gradual decay of the building's cultural ecosystem. The shift from hints of rot to full chaos is abrupt, and since that happens about halfway through, there's an extended period where it seems we're going to be sitting through the maelstrom with no indication of how we're getting out. And despite an excellent cast, Tom Hiddleston is the film's protagonist, Jeremy Irons plays the building's penthouse-bound architect Anthony Royal, which is from the book, but again feels a little too on the nose. Sienna Miller, James Purefoy, and Elizabeth Moss are there as well. The characters tend to blur into one another, to the point where I wanted to cite a moment in the film, but couldn't because I wasn't sure which character was actually involved and how she related to the others. There's lots of vicious, pointed humor in High Rise that's put to good effect, but I was left wishing that the film had cooled it just a little. One of the nastier bits of humor in High Rise is that the architect, Anthony Royal, as befits his name, has seen fit to exercise his droit de seigneur with the building's female tenants. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. There's a certain sense of fury that...
I'm sorry, I must have touched something off there. Hold on, and we will try that again.
Which is from the book, but again feels a little too on the nose. Sienna Miller, James Purefoy, and Elizabeth Moss are there as well. The characters tend to blur into one another, to the point where I wanted to cite a moment in the film, but couldn't because I wasn't sure which character was actually involved. Just a little. One of the nastier bits of humor in High Rise is that the architect, Anthony Royal, as befits his name, has seen fit to exercise his droit de seigneur with the building's female tenants, bedding a number of them and fathering what seems to be a whole herd of kids. That right of a lord to sleep with a newly wedded bride is also the precipitating incident of the unusual Japanese erotic animated film Belladonna of Sadness, originally released in 1973 and getting a digitally restored re-release here on May 6th. Directed by Eiichi Yamamoto and produced by Osamu Tezuka, better known for things like Astro Boy, but not reluctant to delve into more explicit material with his direction of such films as Cleopatra, Queen of Sex. The film is a Devil and Daniel Webster kind of thing, with less exalting of American ideals and more boffing, shall we say, with an innocent and newlywed farm girl, Jean, despoiled by her village's lord, then rising to power through her embrace of the sins brought to her by an increasingly virile demon. This isn't your typical hentai porn anime, and thank God for that, because there's only so much tentacle rape one critic can take. It's a more stylized, experimental look, with an emphasis on line drawing, prominence given to held, dramatic poses over full animation, as is typical for Japanese animation, and production techniques and styles shifting from one sequence to the next. Think more Yellow Submarine than Kimba the White Lion. Expect also to be asking yourself if the filmmakers could have gotten away with both their political and sexual outlooks in today's culture. While there is a brutality to some of the eroticism, Jean's rape is disturbingly rendered as a thick stream of blood that rends the woman in two from crotch to head. There's also a radical embrace of the notion of sin as a kind of liberation. It's not by accident that the evil nobles are rarely seen without a crucifix-bedecked priest by their side. And while an extended orgy sequence does not shy from incorporating the likes of bestiality and urolagna into its action, there's a playfulness overall that doesn't necessarily counterbalance the shock, as reassure the viewer that it's okay in this moment to relish the thrill of such transgression. The Belladonna of Sadness is a genuine oddity, more successful in both its eroticism and its message than many of the live-action champions of the sexual revolution of that time. Makes me wonder what would have happened if these guys had been given a crack at Myra Breckinridge. I'm Dan Persons. Don't be fooled by the pivot. Speak out against hatred. Speak out against fear. Speak out against greed. Speak out against Trump. I'm Dan Persons.
Boy, that doesn't want to quit, does it? Well, it was a good review, an interesting review. I'm looking forward to it being a major James Ballard fan, J.G. Ballard fan. And, yeah, let's see, David Cronenberg made Crash. And, of course, there was a semi-autobiographical movie made out of a semi-autobiographical novel, Empire of the Sun, directed by Steven Spielberg, written by Tom Stoppard. Anyhow, I'd like to test the phone. Mike, are you there?
I am.
Oh, good. It works. It doesn't always. And or I screw things up, which is why Catherine called you. We should explain to people that our guest is Mike Allen. And Mike is, a writer and editor of science fiction, fantasy, horror. He is an award-winning poet. He's a journalist. Puts out the magazine Mythic Delirium, is the author of The Blackfire Concerto, that's a novel, and perhaps, is it fair to say, most prominently editor and publisher of the Clockwork Phoenix series?
I think the Clockwork Phoenix series probably is what I am best known for, although my horror story collection, Unseeming, might be almost an equal contender at this point.
Ooh, congratulations on that. I've not yet read that.
It has a very gruesome cover that I'm very, very proud of.
Yes, it may be. I'm squeamish, so gruesomeness sometimes doesn't always.
Well, it's artistically gruesome. It's not. There's no blood.
No, I've seen the cover. I liked it a lot. Who did that cover? You're very good at choosing covers.
A artist based in London named Daniel Tunstall created that piece. It's a photo manipulation. By the way, hello Jim. Hello New York.
Hello Roanoke.
Yes, yes. Here I am down south at 1:47 a.m. The cover, for those who haven't seen it, it's a view of a woman from the back, and she is reaching around with what appears to be four hands instead of the usual two, and she is peeling her own back open. The skin is coming away, but it's an artistically done image. It's not it's not a grand guignol image,
right? It's not gory.
But Danielle, who I was originally connected to via my friend Dominique Parisian, an editor based out of Canada, works in photo manipulations and has just tons and tons of glorious artwork, much of which is much more gruesome than that piece. But I'm very proud that I could get that one.
So that was actually toned down.
I don't know that she toned it down precisely.
No,
she just did it differently.
Compared to some of her other work.
Oh, yes, yeah. For certain.
Yeah. And let's see. Well, specifically, we should mention that we had, not WBAI, but one of my other lives, New York Review of Science Fiction Readings.
Nursif.
Earlier this month, April 5th, we had the launch party for Clockwork Phoenix 5.
I'm very, very honored that you invited me to have that there.
Oh, it was a thrilling event. We had almost a record crowd. We had a little under 100 people attending, which is pretty darn good. We usually average anywhere between 35 and 50, and we drew just under 100.
It was packed. It was awesome.
it was really good, and it ran really late, and nobody minded.
Which is also great.
Yeah, well, we also had seven acts, as it were, seven readers.
I'm sure that didn't hurt, although I have to say, given the nature of Clockwork Phoenix, the Clockwork Phoenix anthologies showcase stories that are not very easy to classify as to whether they are science fiction or fantasy or horror or otherwise, and they're often very poetic and they're often very dense in their prose. And so it was really wonderful for me as host to introduce story after story after story and have the readers get up and do such terrific jobs with such uncompromisingly artistic work and have a crowd that just ate it up. You know, that was a wonderful thing that I'm going to treasure for the rest of my life, I assure you.
Yeah, and it lives on live stream, although it's a compromised video because the audio drops out. We were having sound problems in the house where everything was feeding back. We made an adjustment to the sound, and somehow that dropped out of the live stream feed. However, I also made an audio recording separately of the event. So at some point, our tech whiz, Terrence Taylor, and I will work to synchronize the two, and then we'll have a good recording without the buzz and with full volume. But that may be a little while from now. But
well, when it happens, I'll definitely promote it wherever I can.
Yeah,
I very much appreciate you taking that trouble, because those readings were special.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they really were. It was an unforgettable event and a lot of fun. Usually we just have two writers or two performers per reading. But this is a special one, and I thought it was well worth it, especially given the diversity of the different kind of stories and readers. Yeah. Now the way you do Clockwork Phoenix is, and I know we're going to have to talk also about Mythic Delirium, and you're now a more diverse publisher, having Bone Swans out,
right?
CSE
Cooney.
Yes, okay. I just think Claire and then the CSE.
Right. Everybody knows her as Claire, but her official author name is CSE Cooney.
Right. And which has gotten excellent reviews. And I've only read two of the stories, but I can see why it's gotten
excellent reviews. One of them is up for a Nebula Award.
That's right.
And who knows, maybe it would have been up for a Hugo Award, except certain recent events have possibly prevented that.
Yeah, although I have to say, everybody gets so angry over the puppies. And I have to say that while the Hugos are honored, I think they're honored more by publishers and certain fans, who, because it's such a democratic award, but the point is, it's totally democratic. Anybody who pays an amount of money can buy a vote.
Right.
And it's therefore akin to, you know, or less than the People's Choice Awards. Whereas the Nebulas, I'm tired myself, the Nebulas are a peer award.
Right.
And there's a limited number. You can't buy a Nebula Award. It used to be that, like the Academy Awards, the Nebulas were very much a peer, backslap, like, oh, yeah, let's give one to this person and to that person because we like them. But that's also become a little more diverse in the last 5 years. And
which is a welcome development.
Yeah. And a few really good things did get nominated for the Hugos. I would say
that is definitely true.
Yeah. If you look at the top three categories, the novel, novella, and novelette categories, those are fairly relatively unsullied. It's the short stories that get sort of wiped out,
right,
by all this nonsense. And
it's easy to guess why that happened. You know, there are so many. We are right now, when I say we, in this case I mean genre writers, people who write science fiction, fantasy, horror, and even the kind of unclassifiable stuff that I publish as an editor. There are so many options for markets, in a way that wasn't true 10 years ago, maybe even 20 years ago. But a result of that, of course, is that, you know, when you have a People's Choice Award, then, you know, the possibilities as to who people might vote for are just all over the place, and it's easy for somebody who is then pushing a slate to sort of come in and override everybody else.
Yeah,
but certainly that's what happened there.
Yeah, it's not just a slate; it's a political thing.
Oh yes,
very much so. It's sort of like a Donald Trump-like person. Who is driving people and saying...
That is a diplomatic way to describe him, yes.
I can't think of anything worse to call somebody. So if you want to call that diplomatic, fine.
I do, actually.
Well, let's put it this way. It's what the FCC will allow.
Yes, exactly.
So therein lies the diplomacy. But you have a very interesting manner of putting together the Clockwork Phoenix anthologies. And, you know, it's not typical. Normally, when a writer of short stories sees that there is a market open, it will define. You know, I am looking for stories that specifically occur while en route to Pluto, or something like that.
A very specific theme, like, you know, dinosaurs on Mars or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's not what I do at all. You're absolutely right. I am not looking so much for a specific subject matter as I am a sort of aesthetic and an ambiance, a tone of story. And there are many different ways that that aesthetic can be arrived at. What's most important to me is that the stories be challenging in some way. And by that, I don't necessarily mean difficult to read. I mean that they give me, as an editor, and then hopefully the reader who receives the completed product, a very eye-opening, refreshing, totally new experience in fiction reading. And my own taste when assembling these anthologies tend to lean, you know, toward poetic prose and stories that will experiment with different techniques in terms of how the story unfolds, and stories that are just really mind-bogglingly sometimes inventive in the settings that they portray, or the nature of the characters that move through the story, or also stories that accomplish some of the same things in more subtle ways. I don't require every single story to be something that is really flashy and avant-garde. They can be kind of quietly unsettling, or just, you know, poetically beautiful, and that is okay, because I am not just, you know, I'm not just trying to select a sort of random group of stories that defy genre expectations. I want the book really to kind of work as an artistic whole. And so I want different kinds of stories that balance each other. And in pursuit of that, I have kind of a secret or not so secret weapon, which is my wife, Anita, who, after I have narrowed the stories down, comes in and works out what order they appear in order to kind of maximize the way the themes and the imagery in the different stories will flow into and contrast with one another. And I know that all sounds like kind of kind of a wild, strange mouthful in terms of explaining how these books work, but they genuinely do work that way. And a number of reviewers of not just the most recent volume, but all five volumes have recognized these qualities about them and gone on about them at great length.
Yeah, we should mention that the latest edition got a starred review from Publishers Weekly.
And it did.
I think number four did as well, didn't it?
Oh, actually, I don't want to say this too loudly. Publishers Weekly didn't like number four, but they did give starred reviews to number two and number three, and a positive review to number one. So on the whole, we win.
Yes, absolutely. Although they gave a spoiler in a matter of like three words.
So, oh, right, with Barbara Krasnov's story.
Yes.
No, that's oh gosh, that's unfortunately a risk with reviews that somebody feels. I guess some reviewer feels that the best way to evaluate the story is also to give away whatever the twist is that makes it so great.
Yeah, actually, if they had simply dropped one word and kept the rest of it.
I don't have it in front of me, so I don't know which word that would have been. But it would have been nice if they thought of it.
The word is dead.
Got you. That's a pretty crucial word.
It really
is. That's a pretty crucial word in a lot of the Clockwork Phoenix stories in that book, I must say.
Well, yes, exactly. And because there is, ultimately, you and Anita did find a theme that we have, I don't remember where, I probably got this phrase from you, but it was that this volume explores the intersection between love and death.
Oh, I don't think I said that. I think another one of the reviewers must have said that.
Maybe so.
But it's absolutely true. And it's just the way...
And it's not necessarily by the way romantic love.
Right.
It can be familial love. It can be...
That's from the Publishers Weekly review.
Oh, it was from the PW. Okay.
Yes. Which was a very astute insight of another from an otherwise spoilery review.
Well, yeah, except for the one story, you know. Yeah. and it was a great review, but...
Well, I'll certainly take it.
Yeah.
I feel like such a nerd when I talk about Publishers Weekly, because I think, you know, the average reader probably doesn't know what Publishers Weekly is.
And the average listener may not know, so perhaps
tell them. Publishers Weekly is a trade journal that a lot of bookstores and libraries use as a guide for what they're going to purchase.
Yes, so, especially libraries and also universities.
Right. And so getting a starred review in Publishers Weekly, especially for a micro press publisher like myself, is a really wonderful thing. Now, I have to share a funny little anecdote. My horror story collection, Unseeming, when that came out in 2014, it also got a starred review.
Ooh.
From Publishers Weekly. And Anita and I got the news while we were on the road, and we had stopped to visit a friend who is a great guy, but you know, isn't particularly big into publishing and would have no reason to be. And so when I was looking at the email I had gotten on my phone from Sonia Tafe, about Unseeming receiving the starred review, I passed this news on to my friend, and he goes, "Oh, well, how many stars?"
Yeah,
and I'm like, "Oh, I had to explain. Alas, it doesn't work like movie review. You just get one star or no stars."
Yeah, you never know. I mean, with restaurants, the highest stars you can get is three.
Right, right.
So, you know, it's different wherever. But a starred review is simply a way of saying noteworthy. And that's the, and the New York Times does the same thing. They simply say a notable pick or
something. Yes.
They use the word notable, where PW says starred. But that's the thing, is that in, for anybody who's a writer, a publisher, a librarian, a person who buys books for any place that has books, the word starred review from PW, you don't have to explain more than that, is one of the highest accolades a book can hope to have.
And I'm sure happy that this book got it, because I put a lot of work into it, and these writers put a lot of work into what they did as well, and then I put them through hoops in some instances to get the stories up to what I kind of pictured they were going to be when I read them, but they weren't quite there yet. That happens sometimes.
Now let me you referred to yourself as a micro presser, to Mythic Delirium.
Right.
As a micro press. What's the print run?
Of Clockwork Phoenix 5?
For example, yeah.
Well, there really isn't a print run. It's print on demand.
Ah, so, okay, yeah, I guess that would fit the category of micro press. Although, I have to say, given the quality of the book, I hope everybody can see me holding it up to the microphone.
I have one, too. I guess I can hold it up to the phone.
Yeah.
Here it is.
We can high-five them, because it's Clockwork Phoenix high-five. Never mind.
Yes.
The
two women on the cover kind of look like they're doing a high-five, you mention it.
actually, I hadn't thought of that. They're extremely pagan. It's better quality than most PODs, print on demands, that I have seen.
Physically. I'm flattered you say that, though I will say, within the science fiction and fantasy field, there is a kind of micro press revolution happening. I'm overstating that a little bit, because it's not really anything new. It's just something that's continuously building. But some of the most important publishers in genre fiction right now, at least in artistic terms, I'm not necessarily talking about in terms of commercial blockbusters, but in terms of expanding and growing, growing the fiction of the genre. Some of the most important publishers right now are working exclusively in print on demand. I'm not saying that I'm one of the most important publishers. I'm just saying that generally this is true.
Well, in some ways you are, and also what I think is different today is that the recognition of what this is and the quality. 10 years ago, when I was doing the show, and I've been doing it since, along with Margot, since 1972, God help us all.
I have to jump in right here, sorry, because I just have to say this. The first time I ever heard of Hour of the Wolf was reading about it in one of Harlan Ellison's introduction to one of his short stories.
Yeah.
And this was back when I was maybe 20 or 21 or something like that.
So it was about 5 years ago.
and so whenever I read one of these introductions by Harlan Ellison or by Isaac Asimov or somebody like that describing these things that happened out there, in the world that involved these authors who I admired, but I had not myself gone down that path. It always seemed to me like, wow, you know, there's just these amazing other things that are happening out there, and I read about them, and I read about them, and maybe someday I'll find out about them in person, and well.
and here we all are. We have arrived.
Yes, yes.
Anyway, I
interrupted you. You were talking about.
Yeah, I interrupt all the time, so it's fair play. The what I was saying is about, you know, 10, 15 years ago, somebody had said, well, yeah, this is something that I published or I did through my press. The term that would have come to mind for most people would have been vanity press.
Right.
And that is no longer the case. I think that there are, in science fiction, I think that probably Kelly Link and Gavin Grant were among the first to change that concept.
Oh, and they're a huge success story, too.
They really are. And in there was a hilarious, not so hilarious story in crime fiction or mystery fiction. Charles R. Dai, A-R-D-A-I, owned his own press because at the time he could afford it, didn't want the way I heard the story, didn't want the waiting time, the lead time that a publisher who would have bought his book would have given. It would have taken like 3 years to come out if he did it himself.
Right.
He could get it out in 6 months. Went ahead and did that, and lo and behold, the book was nominated for an Edgar Award and denied because it was self-published.
That would never stand now.
no, it wouldn't, and it was probably his book that helped change that rule. So today, also, you're publishing other people. You're not just publishing your own work.
That is correct.
So that's essential. I think with Bone Swans, you've broken out to things that you've either written or edited, and it's been a tremendous hit.
It has. You know, of course, this is, you know, I guess it's a hit by genre standards, which I'm proud to say that Claire's book has sold about 3,000 copies at this point.
Yeah. I mean, it's not, yeah, which is better than most genre standards, and I would say it's a hit by independent press standards.
That is a good standard to judge it by. And to reiterate that I am somewhat humble about this sort of thing. It's wonderful to have that those kind of numbers for the kind of thing that I do, but not long ago I was at a dinner for an artist from New York who was visiting here in Roanoke. My actual day job here in Roanoke, Virginia, is I am the arts columnist for the daily newspaper. And so having a dinner with an artist is a thing that does occasionally happen. And I ended up seated across from her husband, who was originally from North Carolina and is a food writer. And he mentioned that in his line of work, a book that sells a few thousand copies would be considered a colossal disaster. So I did not brag too loudly to him about my micro-press genre publishing figures.
Well, you know, it's all relative. It's all relative to where the audience is. And food books are, you know, they go beyond fiction in terms of who they're supposed to be selling to. And when you and then when you add the word genre to that,
right?
And when it's not one of the big, it used to be the big six, now it's the big five,
Right. Because big fish eat little fish, or penguins eat randoms, or something like that.
Right. I don't know that this is so much big fish eating little fish.
Well, I'm saying
big fish sort of melting together.
Yeah, that's sort of like it. I remember at one point I was visiting whichever publisher it was, whichever conglomerate it was, and I was visiting an editor, and I saw that there were like five cubes. Two of them were Doubleday. One of them was Dell, and one of them was Bantam Books. Now, these are companies. Doubleday was like three floors.
Right.
And I worked briefly for Dell Books, freelance. As a first reader. And that was like two-thirds of a floor of a major office building on Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza. And Bantam, when Fred Pohl was the editor there, was, I think it was 666 Fifth Avenue or something satanic like that.
That's a wonderful address.
Yeah, it really is. And they were an entire floor, even though they were part of another company. And now they were these three companies all together were like five cubes. One had an office. The others were cubes. That was it for all of them. And it's humbling to imagine how all these publishers that were major movers and shakers in their day. We have no more Ballantine Books. Ballantine became Del Rey. Del Rey became part of, I don't remember who bought them up. And
Bantam, maybe?
It might have been, but, you know, there is no more Del Rey Books at this point. If not for Ballantine Books, you wouldn't know about Lord of the Rings.
Right.
For example, you know, these companies were movers and shakers, at least in this country. Lord of the Rings had already made its mark at Allen and Unwin in England and had been published here in hardcover. But
you're leaving out the stolen Ace edition, but I guess that's a whole other tangent.
Well, yeah, it was Ace published it with great covers by Jack Gaughan, which had no copyright. There was a problem between British and American copyright
at
that time that we were not following international copyright laws. We were following good old American Trump-like copyright laws.
And America.
So it was not illegal in the United States. This is like saying, "Well, I stole your car, but that's okay. I stole it in such and such a country where, you know, even though where stealing isn't illegal, as long as the person is from another country."
Right.
You know, and that's sort of like what it came out as. And it's a shame because those Jack Gaughan covers were gorgeous.
That is true.
But when Ballantine Books published it, they always had on the back this little squib that said, "You will only buy something that is, you know, true to the author and honors the author's ownership, intellect." Today they would say
what I recall, because I believe my parents had that edition, was there was actually like a note from, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien himself.
That's what I'm referring to. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was on each of the books. I have two out of the three Ace books. And I have all the Ballantine books. And I also have a first edition, but 11th impression. That would be in the U.S. We would call that an 11th printing, but of the original plates of the original George Allen Unwin and Sons books, complete with the color embossed maps sewn into them. That's Not a first edition. They're still worth, instead of many thousands, are worth a few hundred. So I'm proud of those. I'm not a major
book. Well, you should be. I will always have a soft spot for Tolkien myself. I mean, yeah. Lord knows how many people have gotten, sucked into reading fantasy and even science fiction because of those books.
Yeah, and I say this on the air all the time, but I probably haven't mentioned it to you, so I won't go into the whole story, but I spoke to the man.
Oh!
About...
Wow, okay.
Yeah, here at WBAI, Margot Adler, David Marks, and I produced a reading of one chapter from Lord of the Rings, with Tolkien's permission, the Council of Elrond, and which alone takes 100 minutes, just one chapter in the movie, it's 3 minutes. And it's, and Baird Searles was the reader today, they would say, narrator. And he was, he knew Tolkien. And he had published a couple of chapbooks, which those were real micro presses, maybe a print run of 150 or so. And he had written several studies of Tolkien at that point. And at one point, we needed a pronunciation. He gave me a phone number to call to get a pronunciation, and I ended up on the phone. He didn't tell me who I was calling, but I was on the phone with Tolkien.
Oh, wow. Okay.
This is 1972, so about a year before his death.
Wow. Well, I hope, I hope he was helpful.
Well, yes and no.
All right.
Yes and no. The question was, how do you pronounce G-A-N-D-A-L-F? And, in his very heavy Oxfordian come South African accent, he said, well, it's Gandalf. And I said, okay, can you tell me more? And he says, well, it rhymes with half, like half a sixpence. okay, so in American English, it's Gandalf.
All right.
Half a sixpence Gandalf.
Gotcha.
Not Gandalf.
All right.
Which is
everybody thinks of it as Gandalf, I guess, because that's how you would say such a word in America. Gandalf.
And that's actually the way most people would say it in England.
That's fascinating.
But Gandalf. And it was a soft F. It was almost like a V-E.
Okay.
Yeah, having something. So, probably has something to do with, the Beowulfian kind of old English that he and Norse mythology that he was synthesizing. But what of that? I was on the phone with a man for approximately 90 seconds.
Oh, that's cool.
But I can boast, and I do so all the time.
Well, I don't blame you for that. Here in my day job, I actually had an opportunity to interview Ray Bradbury.
Hmm.
So I guess, there are probably, the chances that you've spoken to Ray Bradbury at length are probably much greater than they were for me. But the fact that I managed it is something that I brag about myself.
Oh, I brag about it, too. I had him on the show only the one time because he didn't travel to New York a lot. And generally, you're an exception. I tend not to do phone interviews.
Right. Well, it would have been very difficult to do this otherwise, alas.
I was hoping while you were in New York, but your trip here was very brief.
Right.
3 weeks ago. And but Bradbury was in town to get the National Book Award for Fahrenheit 451.
Okay.
So we did a half hour interview, which I broadcast every so often, and which will be actually commercially available in June. I have not yet discussed this on the air. But
oh, okay. So we've broken some news now.
Yes, we
have. How about that?
There will be an audiobook. of interviews.
Well, if I can keep it, see if I can keep it brief. My Ray Bradbury story emerges from a profile I did of the late author Nelson Slade Bond, who I don't know how familiar your listeners might be with him. He was a fantasy and science fiction writer, although he kind of balked at those terms, mm-hmm. who was most active in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. And he lived here in Roanoke, and he also wrote radio plays.
Ah!
And some of the very first television plays. And his very presence here in Roanoke kind of helped it to become something of a literary center, at least for Southwest Virginia. And I actually got to know him, and in the late 1990s, early 2000s, he made a sort of comeback after having been gone from the fiction magazines and such for decades. And I decided to write a profile about him and got the go-ahead to do that. And Nelson had often spoken to me about interactions he had had with Ray Bradbury, who had written fan letters to him. And so I knew, because I wanted to convey to our readers here in Roanoke that it really was a big deal that this writer that they probably had not heard of, you know, was reemerging. So I wanted to get Ray Bradbury on the record about, you know, why on earth he would be writing fan letters to this man. And I wrote him a letter because, you know, I didn't have access to any sort of phone number for him. And much to my shock and delight, he called me at home. And there's a funny comedy of errors that goes with this that my wife tells much better than I do, where she actually received the phone call first, and I was on my way out the door to go somewhere, and she got this person with this strange deep voice on the line, and she said to him, "Well, he's out right now. Can I take a message?" And the voice on the other end says, "Well, please tell him Ray Bradbury called." And she suddenly says, like, "Wait a minute." And ran outside to catch me before I left. and I managed to, and we had a nice little interview, and I got to quote him, and I got to quote him, and there were coworkers who were very jealous of me when they saw that, which is always fun when that happens.
he was very, very giving kind of person. He was very open and very generous. That's
most certainly.
Yeah, and I remember that. I have another story, but I tell it on the air all the time. I'll tell it to you.
Well, let me. I want to interject something really quick because I just thought of it. The very first volume of Clockwork Phoenix is actually dedicated to Nelson.
So,
yeah, there's a way in which his influence is felt in these books, and that's something that is important to me.
Yeah, I would hope so. I would think so. Yeah, and I remember his name, but for some reason, I seem to remember his name in the context of a collaboration. Did he ever write with other people?
Oh, I don't think so.
Yeah,
he had. I mean, you. We're talking old school here. The way he wrote.
Well, old school might be, you know, C.M. Cornbluth and Fred Pohl.
Well, the way Nelson wrote was he spoke his stories into a dictaphone,
mm.
and his wife Betty, who is a wonderfully accomplished person in her own right. She was kind of a television personality here in Roanoke at one time. Would type the draft from what he dictated, and then he would dictate a new draft, and she would type that up. She was a much faster typist than he was, apparently. And so I can't imagine another author entering into that dynamic. I don't want to completely misportray him. You know, in later years, he used the word processor just like everybody else.
That's
how he did it during his heyday. And in fact, there is a university in West Virginia that has a room in its library dedicated to him, and they have that dictaphone preserved.
That's a little bit
of trivia there.
Yeah, just like there was a place that for years
Marshall University
had Isaac Asimov's typewriter,
right,
in a window. So yeah, I'm just looking up Nelson Slade Bond, because we don't have a computer that can work easily here, but I can vaguely get my phone to work. Yeah. And, books, magazines, television, radio. Oh, there's a lovely cover from Planet Stories.
Yes.
And amazing. Oh, great covers. Great covers. Classic stuff.
And I could tell many, many other stories, but one of the things that's kind of wonderful about the course that my career has taken, I didn't originally plan to become an editor. It kind of was thrust upon me, and I did an okay job at it, and from that learned that it was a skill that I had, and I've continued to use it. And it's led me to cross paths with all sorts of fascinating people, both established figures and established figures and figures like Nelson, who perhaps at one time were much better known, but were still willing to kind of come out of retirement to work with me. And it's also led me to meet a number of very, very talented up and coming writers. And something that Anita and I are very proud of with the Clockwork Phoenix anthologies is we have something of a knack of snagging work from people at the moment, right when or just before their career sort of takes off. I'm definitely expecting similar things to happen with the crew that I've got showcased in Clockwork Phoenix 5.
Yeah, definitely.
An obvious example of what I'm talking about would be from Clockwork Phoenix 2. We had a story from Anne Leckie, who now is getting nominated for and
everything.
Nominated for and winning all sorts of awards for her Ancillary Mercy, Ancillary Sword, et cetera, series. Saladin Ahmed was also in Clockwork Phoenix 2 with a story that ended up being a Nebula nominee.
Right.
I could go on and on and on that way.
Yeah. I want to continue with this theme, but I just realized I have been remiss in not mentioning that the next New York Review of Science Fiction reading is this coming Tuesday.
Oh, that's important to note.
It really is, and I need to promote it.
Who are the readers?
They are Andrea Hairston and Pan Morrigan.
Awesome.
And they
I love
are,
Andrea Hairston's work. Yeah,
she's wonderful. She's wonderful. She has a new novel, Will Do Magic for Small Change. And her stuff is mostly from an independent press as well, Aqueduct Press.
Right.
And this is similar to her, well, it's in the same universe as her Redwood and Wildfire series. And this is reading and music together combined. It's a single performance. Last time she performed for the reading series, we had 8 actors working it all out, and it was and sound effects, and was a lot of fun. And this new book has been reviewed in the New York Times. And also got a starred review in PW.
Yes, yes, yes. And I'm not surprised by that at all. She's also a wonderful poet.
Yes, wonderful she poet. Is. Yes, she is. And teacher from all accounts. So let me just tell people, that's this coming Tuesday, May 3rd, at 388 Atlantic Avenue, where I am right now. The only difference being when we did the Clockwork Phoenix event here, that was on the ground floor, and the radio station is on the third floor.
Right. I didn't get to see the third floor.
It's just as well.
Well, there was plenty going on the ground floor. So.
Yes, yes. And the third floor, I mean, we don't even have soundproofing in the room I'm in. This is allegedly a broadcast studio, so... So it's not quite the same. If we had a real bona fide studio, I would have absolutely forced caused you to come in here and record. I did get Allie Wise in here, Allison.
That's right. That's
Allison
right.
Allison Campbell Wise.
She was. Who is in Clockwork Phoenix 5?
Yes, because she was here for the reading, and since she, I had wanted to do an interview with her. And Fran Wild, who was not in CP5, but...
No, alas, she was not. But she had a new novel come out from Tor, so she's not suffering.
and she's been Nebula-nominated.
Yes.
But the point is that I saw them together at Capclave in Washington, D.C., and I wanted to do interviews then, and then I left a day early and didn't get to do it. So I was able to use the Clockwork Phoenix reading in order to make up for that. So, again, that's this coming Tuesday, May 3rd. People should arrive about 6:30 because you get to order your food and beverage and meet. It's a very camaraderie kind of experience to come to our reading series.
I definitely enjoyed it.
Yeah, admission is free. We will cajole you for donations, but... But nobody is turned away, whether you can donate or not. And for more information, people can go to my website, which is ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF.com, or on Facebook. You can look at the NYRSF Readings website. That's NYRSF, as in New York Review of Science Fiction. Readings, NYRSF, one word, readings, the next word. And both places will have all the information you need. And if that's too much trouble, send me an email, jim@ourwolf.com, and I'll send you all the details. There we go. I've promoted that, and they're Excellent. Just wonderful. And they're nifty pictures and all kinds of links on the website to tell people more about it.
And will that reading also be live streamed?
All of them are.
All right.
I don't over promote that, as you may have noticed with yours, because it's like the football games where they black them out in various cities.
Right.
But I don't think we need to worry too much about New Yorkers not coming because it's available live or after the fact on live stream. I think that out-of-towners will benefit from it. But if you're anywhere in the New York area, it's not the same to simply watch online.
Although, to my pleasant, I was very pleased to learn that, in fact, there were people watching the Clockwork Phoenix 5 live stream as it happened.
Oh, yes, yes.
And you know, the sound problem that you mentioned aside, I got a fair amount of great feedback from that. People really enjoyed it.
Great, and it's still there. That's the other nice thing. And eventually, I have been filming the series for about 6 years, but now with the live stream, we have, you know, three cameras. We can cut from one to the other. Terrence Taylor does a fabulous job with that. And I continue to record them separately, which I've been doing since Gordon Van Gelder started the series 25 years ago. So I have them all on audio. Sooner or later, we'll create a YouTube channel or something.
Okay.
So, but
that will be an ambitious project.
Less so than one would think. It's more ambitious actually to go through my old interviews because they're all on magnetic tape, and I don't mean cassette. We're talking 10-inch reel to reel for 1 hour. A 10-inch reel of tape is 1 hour's worth of recording time at 7.5 inches per second. If it was music, we recorded at 15 inches per second. So a 10-inch reel of tape is half an hour. I have many, more than, 600-700 hours.
Oh, good Lord. Where do you keep all that?
In the basement of my house.
Okay.
You know, fortunately, we rent a house. And they're down there. And if anybody wants to see it, if you go to the Hour of the Wolf page on Facebook, there is a little movie that was made about my tape collection.
Oh, okay.
A 4-minute movie. So people can take a look at that. One of these years, I may get around to trying to fund that project, but it's very expensive to turn old magnetic tape into digital audio. About the only thing I've done it for is the Bradbury interview and another one, my very first live radio show, which was with Isaac Asimov, Lester Del Rey, and Fred Pohl, were my first guests. And that was before Hour of the Wolf. That was 1969, ouch.
I have a friend who is following along with our radio conversation who expressed concern about flooding in your basement. Are you secured against that?
Yes,
these
I
precious
am.
Tapes?
Yes,
okay.
There have been floods in my basement indeed, and the cassette tapes, of which there are many, many pounds just of cassettes, are in plastic containers, and the 10-inch reels are all at least 3 feet off the ground.
Okay, good.
And the worst flood we've had has been about 2 inches.
Okay, good. I know of a few things about flooding basements myself.
Oh, dear.
Well, yeah, Roanoke has had... Roanoke has an interesting history with flooding. Our city is in a valley surrounded by mountains, and we get all sorts of very curious weather patterns.
And to begin with, it disappeared, right? Or was it that people came there?
Oh, no, that's a different Roanoke.
Oh, that's a different Roanoke.
Everybody makes that mistake.
Ah.
Everybody. I think even Philip Jose Farmer in one of his books, makes that mistake about our Roanoke being the one that vanished. But no, the Roanoke that vanished is located on what's now the coast of North Carolina.
Ah, okay. And that's why nobody knows that, because it vanished.
Yes. And so we're maybe the second best known Roanoke, and so everybody assumes that it's us.
I actually did. Maybe it was P.J. Farmer that made me think it.
It could be. And, you know, I mean, and he should have known better because he had relatives who live here.
Yeah, but then again, You know, anybody who...
It's fiction anyway. Why not?
You know? Anybody who would adopt pseudonyms just to write certain books.
Yes.
And I not adopt, legally adopt. That's a whole other story, and I don't remember all the details. But in order to use a famous fictional but copyrighted name...
Right.
He legally changed his name to write... under the name Kilgore Trout.
I was going to say, you're talking about Kilgore Trout.
I am. And so he somehow in one state legally changed his name for a matter of like 1 month.
Clever.
he was a trickster. I think that's a good term for what he did and who he was.
Gotcha. Well, there's definitely, you know, literary tricksters are needed.
Well, yeah, and he was one of the best. So what other tricks have you got coming up?
Oh, gosh. Well, my upcoming year, of course, I'm going to be focused a lot on promoting, you know, Clockwork Phoenix 5, the anthology we've talked about on and off through this. And I also have a new collection out, my second collection of short stories. It's called The Spider Tapestries. That actually came out the month before Clockwork Phoenix 5. And though I wasn't expecting it, it's a very small, very strange book. Even strange, I'm somebody who I guess is really, really known for strange now, and The Spider Tapestries is the strangest book I've ever put out. But it got nice reviews in Publishers Weekly and in Library Journal, has gotten some nice notice out there, and so that is something that I'm also going to be pushing. On top of that, I have a novel that I'm working on. My working title right now is Trail of Shadows. That it's actually probably in about its fifth draft, but absolutely nothing is set in stone, but a fairly important figure in the industry has expressed some interest in at least looking at it, so I need to get it up to snuff. So that it can put its best foot forward once I send it to this person. So
very
crossing
good.
My fingers there, have a lot to do. Of course, I will be continuing to assemble issues of my magazine.
We haven't even discussed Mythic Delirium.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Mythic Delirium has evolved. Mythic Delirium is almost 20 years old, but it is a journal of fiction and poetry that I publish. I guess it's the main publication of the Mythic Delirium books, Micropress, although Clockwork Phoenix actually gets a lot more attention, I guess, because it's a book as opposed to
a periodical, yeah.
Right, I publish both fiction and poetry. Mythic Delirium used to be only poetry, but I changed that in 2013 with the help of a Kickstarter. I have to say, thank God for Kickstarter. A lot of these projects I do, including Clockwork Phoenix, would not be possible. Margot
Atwell, who's been on this program, will be very glad to hear that.
Well, good.
I assume you know her.
I don't.
Oh, wow.
Know that I do.
Okay, Margot Atwell is the, I don't remember exactly what her title is, but suffice it to say, she works for Kickstarter and is the science fiction and fantasy, she's the genre publishing advocate there.
So she's
rather important.
I wonder if I've had some contact with her. It's funny, I actually, in my day job... You know, it's funny how these things work. In my day job, I actually interviewed Yancey Strickler, who is one of the founders of Kickstarter. Who was a student at Virginia Tech, which is about a half hour away from Roanoke. And so I've had that contact with Kickstarter people. But, you know, my own
Kickstarter itself is actually, I didn't even realize, located right here in Brooklyn.
Oh, that doesn't surprise me at all.
It's about 45-minute walk from where I am right now.
Yeah, is it an unassuming little office, or is it?
It's an unassuming outdoor place.
Okay.
When you go inside, you realize it's a huge former warehouse.
Interesting.
And they have hot and cold running coffee every few stations. It's an amazing place. No offices, all benches and everything like that. It's and a beautiful roof garden from which you can see almost anywhere.
Well, since I've mentioned Mythic Delirium, I obviously should mention mythicdelirium.com, which is where you find it. It's a webzine now. It used to be a little saddle stapled zine in the classic sense of a zine, but now every poem and story that I publish through it is made available eventually on the website. And our most recent issue, which went live at the beginning of April, just before I came down to up. From here, it's up to Brooklyn to Brooklyn to host the Clockwork Phoenix 5 reading. Right now, we have a new story from Roshani Chokshi. She's a young adult fiction writer whose first novel is just about to come out, and we have new poetry from Theodora Goss, who may well be familiar to your listeners there, and also from Virginia Mollaire, another poet and short story writer and a good friend of mine. And there are other works that will become available in May and June. I do this thing where I publish the issues quarterly, and they're made available in full if you're a subscriber or if you have or if you purchase one of the ebook editions. And then on the website, I make a little bit of the content available each month. By the end of the quarter, the complete issue is posted online. And then we move on to the next issue.
That's a good way of doing it. It's a fun way of doing it.
Yes.
And hopefully it's one that also eventually, gets income.
Well, I don't really publish Mythic Delirium to generate income. It has always supported itself. That's the one condition I set for it when I began, was that if it quit supporting itself, I would stop doing it.
Well, income doesn't mean profit.
Right, right.
And God knows with my reading series, with the exception of the one that you did, we're usually at a loss.
Well, I am glad to have given you a win.
Oh, yeah. It was for us a major windfall, let there be a full disclosure. Usually we lose anywhere between $20 and $30. Not a big deal.
Okay.
But it's about something. And we profited from your reading, maybe about $150.
That works. I'm very pleased to hear that.
And that's after buying that lovely apple cake.
Which was a very tasty cake.
Yeah, I didn't get to partake of it. I'm diabetic. I chose it, and it looked good. Right here on Atlantic Avenue. We are almost, believe it or not, out of time. We have about a minute and a half left. So let us, for those people who aren't watching their radios carefully, spell mythicdelirium.com.
Oh, good idea. It is mythicdelirium clockworkphoenix.com.
And from there, I assume people can also look up and learn all about Clockwork Phoenix 5.
Oh, yes. You can access information on how to order the all five books in the Clockwork Phoenix series and Bone Swans by C.S.E. Cooney, Claire Cooney, and The Spider Tapestries, the new book of mine, and a number of other works that I've put out over the years.
Yeah, and they're really remarkable. It's they're a lot of fun, and I think you do a remarkable job as both an editor and publisher and writer.
Thank you.
It's a great thing. So what can I say beyond that? I'm very pleased. And we need to repeat that you are Mike Allen.
Yes, indeed.
You know, for those who just tuned in, this broadcast, of course, is available for about 3 or 4 months worldwide. And I'll send you that link. It'll be on Facebook in the morning.
Great.
And or the WBAI website in about 4 minutes, but they archive the whole thing and then stays there for about 3 or 4 months, which is nice, not the way it used to be. So once again, Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jim, for having me. This was very enjoyable.
I'm glad. I know we kept you up late. You're an East Coaster like me, but what can I say? I hope you had fun.
I did very much.
Okay, so thanks, and I'll speak with you soon.
All right.
Take care.
Bye bye, New York.
Bye bye, Roanoke. Good morning. And this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. I will not be here next week. Why? Well, we haven't had a fundraising drive in almost 7 weeks. That means we're starting one next week, doesn't it? May 1st, I began at WBAI May 1st, 1967. So it would be my 49th anniversary of working here. Lord love a duck. And I will be here, however, in 2 weeks, and I'll be doing a midnight to 3 slot, and that's going to be very special. We're planning it out, having a lot to do with POC and SF. Well, if you don't know what that means, we'll explain at some point. Visit us on Facebook, visit us at ourwolf.com. Check out mythicdelirium.com. And as I always say, everybody, please, please be good to each other, because the world is lacking way too much of civility. Be somebody to help change that. Have a wonderful morning. See you in 2 weeks. And take care.
My sails have sailed. when I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
a bitch. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. While I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk my people, the people all around the pig work. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my writing, is writing the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm no lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too. Burn the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno. Cause my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. To wake up to the lies, the pigs make up imperialistic swines that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist, cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I ragging and snagging and dragging and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Number one, Panama. Talking about Peru. Azania. Brixton. Belfast. And forget Korea. Beirut. And forget Haiti. Iran. Puerto Rico. Colombia. Mexico. Talk about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua. East and South Central LA. California, IA. Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will. Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx. Yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag.
Number one.
That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. The free book. This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother. You gave me freedom of speech in the first.
tonight. While you're there, you remember all the things that I taught you to do. You will be there by yourself, reminiscing all the things that I taught you to do.
Right here until
Lord of mercy.
Yeah, we burn the impurest red, white, and blue to ashes.
Yeah, just lean with it, rock with
and
it.
If it won't burn, dip it
Lord
in the acid.
Yeah, just lean with it, rock
99 Cinco list alive
it.
Until 5 o'clock.
Lord of mercy.
Yeah.
Yeah, just lean with it, rock with it. Finger snap with it.
Yo.
Lord of mercy.
Toronto.
Yeah, just lean with it, rock with it. Hot
Montreal.
With it.
Brooklyn.
But me say, who tell me that no the girl named Shelly? Shelly, and she a dance and a roll her belly. Belly, Alina house now have time fi watch telly. Telly, send me some Red Bull and Guinness, yeah, Delhi. Delhi, and me wanna put some hot pot on the Kelly. Ring ding 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 ding, gyal a ring up me Shelly. Gyal over gone now have time fi ask Kelly. Brand new dance me bust it before Ellie. Lean with it, rock with it, hot funk with it. Lord of mercy, yeah, just lean with it, rock with it, hot funk with it. Lord of mercy, yeah, just lean with it, rock with it, finger snap with it. Lord of mercy, yeah, just lean with it, rock with it, hot funk with it. Mercy, but I miss it from uptown Mondays to weddy. Ya old gala at my rock steady. All down a blazy, them a tweet. Down a passa, them black off the street. Some do it fast, I miss it, some do it slow. Hot, a tweet, bad man, not too glow. The Japanese, them want see how we go. Attitude, y'all, oh, no bad soul. Lean with it, rock with it, hot funk with it. Lord of mercy, yeah, just lean with it, rock with it, hot funk with it. Lord of mercy, yeah, just lean with it, rock with it, finger snap with it. Lord of mercy, yeah, just lean with it, rock with it, hot funk with it. Have mercy, but me say lean with it, rock with it, hot funk with it. Lord of mercy, yeah, just lean with it, rock with it, then dance with it. Lord of mercy, yeah, that's lean with it, rock with it, hot funk with it. Lord of mercy, yeah, that's lean with it, rock with it, then snap with it. Have mercy, I know, yes I know.
Casa, no. This the one you gotta Mexico. Gonna all the way you stand for a mingo. A Messaline with a truck with it. A Dustaline with it, stop with it. A Dustaline with it, rock with it. And if you want, you hot, hot with it.